Ladies and gentlemen, although this is the end of the final session, we're not done quite yet. We still have some summing up to do. And I'm very pleased to ask you to welcome to the stage Professor Craig Calhoun, the LSE Director and President, and Professor Sir Chris Pissarides.
At this end of a wonderful day, stimulating, interesting series of sessions, I'm pleased to welcome to the Asia Forum and to the podium the LSE's Professor Sir Christopher Pissarides. Chris will speak for around 20 minutes, giving his thoughts on the day's discussions. I want you to be clear that these are the thoughts of an extraordinarily distinguished intellectual and economist. Sir Christopher Pissarides is an LSE alumnus, so you already know that he's smart. He is the Regius Professor of Economics at LSE. He's also a school professor, like Tim Besley, whom I introduced at lunch, one of the handful of professors we recognize as being of pivotal importance to the entire school, as well as to their departments. In 2010, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences for his work with Peter Diamond and Dale Mortensen on the analysis of markets with search fictions. In 2013, he was appointed chair of the National Economic Council of Cyprus. It wasn't enough to be honored by his native country in this way. In the same year, he was knighted for his services to economics in the Queen's birthday list. Sir Christopher Pissarides.
Thank you very much, Craig. As Tim said at lunchtime, if my mother was in the audience, she would have believed you probably. it's late in the day. As you can see, I had about 10 seconds to prepare my summary. You are probably tired, so if you feel like leaning back and going to sleep for 20 minutes, I will not object. I promise you I'll make a very loud noise when I finish so that you'll wake up and you give me a warm applause for my summary. And then we'll all be happy at the end. I mean, it's been a wonderful day. I've learned a lot. I do enjoy a lot more going to conferences where the sessions are not in what I do in economics, because I actually leave having learned something rather than just argue with my colleagues about how to model this particular friction in the labor market or the other. So it's been very rewarding. Now, I took some comfort from the fact that when I look at the program, it doesn't say that I'm supposed to sum up, but it says some reflections from my perspective on the events, which is a lot easier. Now, partly because of where I live and what I do now, I think of myself as a Eurocentric economist. So there is Europe and economics. And one common theme that ran through all the sessions of today is that Europe either not getting a mention or getting a mention of how useless it is in today's international economy. The only complimentary thing said about Europe was that it has good football teams. And I should be grateful to Jan who said it, that he didn't carry on to say that that's because the best players of Latin America and Africa are playing Europe, with minor exceptions. We still have Ronaldo, I guess, and he comes from Southern Europe too. As for the economics, we were told time and over again that politics is more important than economic development. Economists have got it all wrong. We should look at politicians, leaders, and so on. Well, before I give you some reflections on what was said, I want to defend both of those, both Europe and the economists. Now, for Europe, it's very easy. Let me ask you, what car would you like to drive? I think 99% of you will say European car. Maybe German, but never mind. I mean, they are still part of Europe. What clothes would you like to wear? I'm sure most of you will say Italian clothes. European still. When you go home, if you can afford it, or if you go to a shop that is selling domestic appliances, what would be your favorite domestic appliance? Washing machine, dishwashers, if you have cookers in the kitchen. I guarantee you they will all be European. What art would you like to have hanging on your walls in your house? European. So we're not doing that badly. We missed out on computers, maybe, but, computers reduce productivity of labor, as we know anyway. I still use a European pen to write. Now, what about the economists? Well, I think the reason that that economists do not have much more to contribute, if I can read it that way, is because we've actually managed to understand what's going on. We've got the theory that explains what's going on. We know what is needed for economic development. We know what is needed to sort out the IMF and the asymmetries and the imbalances. The problem is that we don't have the power to implement all that. So it's not our fault in a way that we need to study politics. We don't really need to study politics. What we need is charismatic politicians who will preferably be trained in economics and therefore who will be able to apply good economic policies. And we have many, many examples, of course, of politicians getting it wrong, not just the very obvious ones like you look at Korea from space and one is full of light and the other is dark. I mean, and here I do take a lot of comfort from Charles Goodhart's reassurance that Germany is not going to be the hegemon of the world, speaking as a Greek primarily. They even have people with some economic knowledge leading the country, but they're still not getting it right in the way that economists are saying they should, what economists are saying they should do to bring economic development fast. So it's not economists you should be criticizing. Economists have moved ahead and they know what to recommend. But we do have to rely on politicians to apply what we're recommending. Let me now get to more specifics, and I'm going to say something about politics. I'm going to say something more about politics, in fact, later on. But before I go into the sessions, I would like to say something about the Prime Minister's speech that was read this morning. And I was particularly interested about something I didn't know, in fact. And I wish I knew this just over a year ago rather than now, which is that Malaysia, during the 1998 financial crisis, actually rejected the IMF prescriptions and they recovered faster than the other countries that have taken on the IMF restrictions with all their conditionality. And of course, speaking as a European now, and as a Southern European, and one who advises a government that is now busy implementing the IMF conditionalities on the country, that is a very interesting thing to hear. I wish I had heard of it 18 months ago, and then I would have taken the plane, come here and sit with the Prime Minister or his economic advisors and ask them how did they do it by saying no to the IMF. And maybe some people would have been happier back in my country too. Now, talking about politics now, I quite enjoyed listening to my colleague Arne Westad, since I don't think we ever got the chance to talk very much to the LSE, because as you know, we have a wonderful new building for economics, but it's about 5 minutes away from the other buildings of the LSE, and that's a great barrier when it comes to academics to talking to each other. But I really enjoyed listening to him, and I've been thinking and reflecting about his plea for cooperation in Southeast Asia and the ASEAN countries. And he said that let's cooperate without borders. Let's not draw the borders and cooperate in economic development, and that would make everyone better off, and maybe the politicians will come around to it in the end, and we'll see it, and we'll see what the benefits are from that. I'm afraid, as much as I'd like to believe that, I think that involves a little bit of wishful thinking on his part. I don't really know of examples where politicians have actually, or other countries have actually cooperated in economic development without a political agreement beforehand on how the goods will be shared. And so many times that cooperation doesn't come along because there's disagreement on how they would be shared. And in fact, this one brings me back to Danny Kwa's plea for charismatic leaders to lead us through. And in fact, even that one, speaking as someone very familiar with recent European history, even that one is dangerous sometimes. You see, look at the European countries, which a few years ago, a few decades ago, they were where ASEAN countries are now in trying to bring about more cooperation to avoid wars. And immediately after the Second World War, they came together. They said, you know, we've been destroying our continent. There are mutual benefits from cooperation. We all got together to cooperate. And it was okay as far as we just had free trade and maybe freedom of movement of capital within our countries. But then it's obvious now that that countries were not ready at that time, even up to the 1980s, to form the kind of union that the charismatic leaders of the time had in mind. Now, Europe, at that time, we thought, I included, we thought that we were very lucky to have those charismatic leaders that were bringing us all together, Schuman, Delors, Giscard d'Estaing, Helmut Schmidt. In fact, one of the most enlightening experiences I had in this, in fact, was listening to a double act by Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, the president of France, and Helmut Schmidt in the Old Theater at the LSE, when they came sometime in the mid-1990s, I think it was, to tell us about the great benefits of closer European integration, common currency, everything. They agreed on everything except for one thing. When one student, and fancy LSE students, to ask the embarrassing, difficult questions even to people like Helmut Schmidt and Giscard d'Estaing, he got up and said, "What language will the integrated Europe speak? Will there have to be need to develop a new language?" And Helmut Schmidt immediately got up and said, "We do have a common language, it's English." To which you can imagine the expression on Giscard d'Estaing's face as he looked down. But apart from that, it was complete agreement. And of course, you know, I mean, I was persuaded myself that that was the best route. In fact, after that, I went and joined the Monetary Policy Committee of the Central Bank of Cyprus, whose remit was to introduce the euro to the island, and we did it after 7 years, which was record time, in fact back then. But it's obvious, though, that that Europe was just not ready to cooperate to the extent that was needed by the single currency. Once those leaders had gone, the new set of leaders are exactly what was described by one of you in that session, not Danny, I think, which is that when they attend the meetings of the whole region, they sound like great regional leaders, like leaders for the whole group. And that's what we hear in Brussels when we go. But when they go back home, they talk like national leaders, and what they look after is their own national interests. And you cannot have a very close economic union, especially with a common currency, but even with common sharing of resources, when leaders go back to their own countries and then they start saying, "We're going to get more out of this union." I mean, you hear Cameron saying that all the time. Even Merkel and Schäuble are saying it all the time. They're saying, you know, we have our surpluses, we're fine, why should we do anything else? Which brings me to the point that Charles was making. And then you have these southern ones saying, we need more money, and Germany saying, so you cannot have any more. Now, in fact, this is, as an aside, it's demographic. According to Germany, the reason for not giving money to the southern countries, apart from not wanting to do it because it was their fault that they built up the debts and all that, is the demographics. They are saying that very soon, because of demographic developments, they are not going to have surpluses, and therefore they need to save that money to pay for the pensions of people of Charles' age. as he reminds me. So I don't know how you feel being British, but if you were German, you shouldn't feel bad at all. Your pension will be paid right to the end. So my response, my reflection, if you like, in the discussion about politics and economics is that it's better to take it much more slowly, much more gradually, and make sure that at least culturally or whatever any reason, you really are ready to come into closer union with your neighbors. Otherwise, just have free trade and that's enough. Anything more than that would just complicate relations too much until you're ready. But quite honestly, I don't know countries that are ready to come into that much closer union anymore, except for countries like Germany and Austria, maybe Germany and Netherlands, Finland. But apart from that, everyone else, even in Europe, after 70 years of attempts to bring us closer, we're not quite ready. We still feel like our own, more about our own nationalities than about the nationality of the whole. Now some comments on cities. What I was very interested, because cities and urban economics and all that is one of my interests outside economics, although economists are getting interested in that, but I always sometimes think, what would I want to be in my next life? And sometimes I think I want to be a town planner. But then I realized that I'd probably be even more poorer than as an economics professor if I were a town planner, so maybe that's not a good idea. Although maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, maybe Ricky knows to correct me. And other times I think I want to be a geologist, but that is not much good either. So I should learn some finance, I think. Now some comments on cities. I was very interested, actually, by one point that was made by Mike Douglas on cities. Of course, the whole thing was interesting, lovely pictures and all that. But reflecting on that as an economist, I was very interested by a point that was made by Mike. And in fact, that relates to some work that I'm doing in economics now, which concerns structural change and deindustrialization. Now, he said cities now, and especially so starting in the 1980s, have become centers of production rather than centers of culture and social relationships and all that. And that's true, but that's due to the deindustrialization and the development of the service economy. I think you see, if your main production activity is industry, then you can locate industry almost anywhere. All you need is a good railway network to transfer the goods. And we saw it in Britain, for example, which industrialized all the way from London to Manchester, Midlands, Newcastle on the north, east, and so on. So people moved to cities in that environment, mainly for social and cultural reasons, or at least a very big reason for moving there. But once you move away from industry and into the service economy, then you do need to live together to enjoy the services. You cannot provide, or rather, there are very few services that you can provide in Newcastle and enjoy them in London, for example. You know, maybe finance if it's digitalized and all that. But even that one wouldn't be appropriate. It wouldn't be as effective. So as employment in industry is declining and employment in services rising throughout the world, you would expect to see more and more concentration in cities, and cities becoming more centers of production. And I think it's important for urban planners and theorists to realize that that's linked with an inevitable structural transformation that is taking place in the economy. Now, why is it taking place? Well, because of technology. I mean, it was said in one of the sessions that technology kills jobs, but it doesn't kill production. You know, technology makes us more productive, so we don't need as many workers to produce even more and more goods. What do those workers do when they don't leave the labor force or become unemployed? They go and join the service sector, because the service sector cannot enjoy big technological improvements, especially with the aging population. The service sector will be dominated by healthcare, nursing, and all other kinds of services. And there's really no limit to how many services we can consume as consumers, but there are limits to how many manufacturing goods we can consume. You know, I mean, how many cars are you going to own? How many houses are you going to own? There is limited time. You know, you just cannot consume all those. But with services, there's no limit to how many you're going to consume. And therefore, I would expect cities to become even more of centers of production than they are now. And we have to face that. And talking about public transport as being the major one, that's very important. I felt rather good because there are three cities in the world that I spend more than 1 month a year. That's London, Hong Kong, and Nicosia, Cyprus. I have to admit with embarrassment that in Nicosia, Cyprus, I do drive a German car and move myself around from one place to the other. It's too small a city to have an efficient public transport system. But in London and Hong Kong, I always travel on the public transport with a free pass provided by the mayors of those cities. In London, it has the heroic name of the Freedom Pass. Very proud holder of the Freedom Pass. But in Hong Kong, you won't believe what it's called. It's called the Elderly Octopus. I never thought of myself as an elderly octopus. But I'm not sure I like either one or the other, but in combination it's even worse. But it works. It gets you from one point to another for, I think, two Hong Kong dollars, actually, which is a ridiculous amount to charge. I think the administration of collecting that money from your elderly octopus is probably more than the money you pay. But anyway. So I do hope that there is more work in that field. I'll be very interested in following to see what I can recommend to my people in Nicosia who do not have any kind of public transport. They're like KL, I guess, but the population there is only 200,000, whereas here I think it's a little bit more than that. And finally, on finance, I mean, why would we have the most depressing topic of all at the end? I don't know, but it did depress me when everyone said the IMF system is broken, deflation is coming, there are all these asymmetries that we don't know how to deal with. Any attempt to reform will be blocked by America because it doesn't pay them. They only care about themselves and not about anyone else, but we don't have any other leader. They are not encouraging thoughts to go home with. I agree about the IMF. I hope, I don't know if the best way to do it is to recall a Bretton Woods conference and do it, but if Americans are going to block it, what's the point? Do we let central banks develop their own swap system informally? Well, unfortunately, my country doesn't have a central bank anymore. We have to rely on the German-led European Central Bank, which I'm sure will not do dirty tricks like that, if that's what they are. What do we do about inflation? Well, you know, maybe all senior age went to the Americans, but at least they provided some kind of inflationary injections into the world economy that made positive interest, that kept interest rates positive without discouraging investment. I don't know what will happen if we go to a system, a deflationary system, partly demographics and partly energy, as Charles was saying. So that, I'm afraid, is just a depressing thought that I don't know the answer to. With that thought, I leave you. Thank you.